A disappearance in Damascus.
A man came in, and I could immediately tell he was one of those people that no matter what he's wearing, he looks like he's wearing a uniform. And I immediately knew what was going on. He came up to her, and the three of us just stood there for a moment. And then he said to Ahlam in Arabic, "Get rid of her."
That's journalist Melissa Fleming. We talk with her about her terrific new book, A Disappearance in Damascus. Then we re-air our interview earlier this year with Melissa Fleming about her book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. As this show is being produced, the news came that the Supreme Court has upheld part of Donald Trump's Muslim ban, the part blocking new refugees coming from six majority Muslim nations. The justices reversed rulings by a federal judge in Hawaii and the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco. The ban will affect some 24,000 refugees seeking asylum. Among them are those fleeing war-torn Syria. Today, we feature the stories of two refugees from Syria, one who fled first from Iraq into Syria and then had to flee Syria to the United States before Trump's Muslim ban. The other story is about a Syrian refugee who barely survived the treacherous crossing from Turkey to Italy across the Mediterranean. Both stories are about the true cost of war, a cost few Americans ever get to see. Most of the coverage of wars in the Middle East focus on terrorism. When they do report on victims, their subjects are mostly American soldiers. Seldom do we see the horrific cost of war on civilians, yet they are the ones who suffer the most. But for my guest, journalist Deborah Campbell, civilians are the story. She practices a kind of immersive journalism that embeds itself among its subjects, many of them women and girls who are refugees from our wars in the Middle East. She reported from Iraq, and then when Iraqis streamed into Syria by the thousands to escape sectarian violence in Syria. Looking for a fixer to help her get sources and to translate, Deborah Campbell found Ahlam, a courageous and capable Iraqi refugee woman who not only worked for journalists, but also helped her fellow refugees in a myriad of ways. The two developed a strong working relationship, and then a friendship, forged by the risks they both took in Syria's police state. A Disappearance in Damascus tells the remarkable story of Ahlam and Campbell in vivid prose. Through that story, it illuminates the larger one, the terrible toll war is taking on the civilian populations of the Middle East and the U.S. role in creating that disaster. Deborah Campbell, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
This book, Disappearance in Damascus, first I want to say it was a terrific read, just very, very powerful book. It's a story of a woman that you met in Syria who was your fixer, that is, and you can describe or explain what a fixer is. But first I want to ask you, why were you in Syria? What were you doing there?
Well, I went to Syria in 2007. I was there through 2008. And my initial goal was to write a story for Harper's Magazine on the Iraqi refugee crisis. At the time, it was the biggest humanitarian catastrophe in the world, and about a million and a half Iraqis had fled across the border into Syria, most of them to Damascus, in the 12 to 18 months before I arrived there. So I was going to document the human cost of the Iraq war. I wanted to talk to the eyewitnesses. I also wanted to really get close to civilians who had lived the war to hear their stories, and it was something that as a journalist, I couldn't do in Iraq because it was the most dangerous country in the world for journalists at that time. And right now, it's roughly the second most dangerous after Syria.
Yes. And Syria, at the time that you went, Syria was a pretty prosperous place. Of course, that's quite different at this point. Tell us about that moment. Why were people fleeing into Syria?
Well, Syria, we think of Syria now as a war-torn place, but at the time it was a refuge from war. It was the last open border with Iraq. All of the other surrounding countries had closed their borders, and Syria was a place where they could find refuge, rent apartments, and they were hoping to wait out the war and be able to go back home. The reason that they were fleeing, and mostly this was the professional class, it was really the people who kept the country running, the doctors and lawyers and technocrats and all the way through to the filmmakers and novelists, they were the people that had left. And at the time, about 1,000 civilians a month were being found dead on the streets of Baghdad during the height of the civil war, when during the vacuum of power after the fall of Saddam Hussein, you had militias that were fighting one another and this rise of sectarianism, religious strife. And so for the average civilian, it wasn't even safe to walk out your door, and they were being threatened, murdered, killed based on their identity cards, based on which religious sect they're surname would identify them as. And so they had taken their families, grabbed the kids and the cash, and just left.
You know, I think a lot of Americans are under the notion that, well, you know, these are sectarian conflicts that have existed since forever. I mean, I've heard a lot of people say that. But you say that, no, things were actually different. Not that Saddam was not a dictator, he certainly was. But that the U.S. had a very big part to play in the growth of the sectarianism. I wonder if you could connect the dots for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, Saddam Hussein was the strong man. But once you remove a strong man, if you don't have civil institutions that bind people together, a sense of rule of law, basic needs being met, electricity, for example, which became sporadic after the invasion and the destruction of so much infrastructure, then things devolve into chaos. And largely what it was a fight for power. Yes, people did divide into sects, as people tend to get very tribal in times of conflict. I mean, we're seeing that in many parts of the world, where suddenly people find that their identities are how they find the people that are going to so-called take care of them by whatever means. And so with this vacuum of power, and at the same time when the coalition provisional government came in, what they did immediately was disband the Iraqi army. We're talking about 500,000 men who are trained in nothing but war, and put them on the street without jobs, without money, with families to support, and well armed, and they also left the weapons depots unguarded. So that happened. And the second thing that happened was that they decided to purge the bureaucracy. They fired about 100,000 white-collar workers who had been members of Saddam Hussein's Ba'ath Party, without considering that people joined the party not necessarily because they had any love for Saddam Hussein, but in order to avoid police harassment, in order to keep their jobs, and anyone who did a master's degree or a PhD had to join the party. So essentially, these were the most educated people in the country, exactly the people that you need if you want to hold a country together in the absence of leadership. And so at this point, you left the sort of the worst elements of the society, the most dangerous elements of society, to start fighting for power. And the Shia and the Kurds were essentially handed power in the new government by the coalition. And the people that took power weren't broad-minded. They had long been fighting in a sectarian way. So, and because Saddam was Sunni, and because a good number of the white-collar and the Ba'ath Party members were Sunni, they were all of a sudden all lumped together and marginalized. And not only that, but persecuted, had their homes looted, and began becoming the victims of targeted killings. And it devolved into the fact that anyone who was Sunni would then be targeted by death squads that were, some of them, run out of the new Shia government.
as well as kidnappers. And that brings us to Alam. She was actually kidnapped at a certain point. Tell us about Alam.
Well, so when I arrived in Syria, I was looking to get as close as I could to the refugee community. And the kind of work that I do is immersive journalism. So it's not a matter of parachuting in and then leaving in 3 days or a week. So I like to go and spend a lot of time and see life from the inside. Now, when you want to do that kind of work with people who are running from strangers who want to kill them, they aren't necessarily open to answering questions from a stranger like me. So I was looking for someone that the community trusted who could make introductions for me and open some doors and also do some interpreting. I've studied classical Arabic, but I'm by no means fluent in it. And in any way, classical Arabic isn't really so much spoken anyway. So I had the good fortune to meet an Iraqi woman. She had worked as a fixer in Baghdad for the Wall Street Journal, and she later was running a humanitarian center on behalf of the U.S. Civil Affairs in Baghdad until she was kidnapped for that work, for being associated with the Americans, as happened to so many people. And when her family paid the ransom, which was contingent upon her leaving the country, she came to Syria. There, she was supporting her family by working as a fixer for really all of the major foreign correspondents like BBC or Al Jazeera and so forth, and also for human rights groups like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch. And she was also a real community leader, and this is what gave her access and created trust, because she was kind of like a one-woman NGO. And in the most concentrated group of refugees, about 300,000 of them that lived in a neighborhood called Zainab, or sometimes called Little Baghdad. And through her, I got the access that I needed. That's how I met her.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Deborah Campbell about her book, Disappearance in Damascus. She was a remarkable woman, which is just hinted at what you said. Describe her a little bit more, what she was like as you came to know her.
Right. Well, she at the time, she was in her early 40s, and she was funny, smart, and street smart, which is what you want in a fixer. And she came from a small village outside of Baghdad. She was the first girl in her village ever to go to high school. Rural girls usually went to school for a year or two. And she was also the first male or female to graduate with a university degree. The reason she was able to do this was because her father was the sheikh of the small village she came from. And he had a sort of progressive outlook on things. Even though he wasn't an educated man himself, he thought that the world was changing. He saw education as a weapon. And when the local men came to protest that a village girl didn't need an education in order to tend the date palms and the orange trees, and that, you know, it could be a problem in the long run, he said to them, "Nobody knows what the future holds." And she goes. And so he was very instrumental in supporting that for her. And because of her education, and because she later studied English, she became a kind of go-between for the community that she came from, which was increasingly under stress because of the war. There were massive numbers of war injuries and insurmountable problems, and with the Americans who came through. So she assumed this role, which in any other situation would have been strange. And of course, that role both brought her to prominence and gave her a lot of power to get things done, but also put her in danger.
Yeah, you say at one point, you ask the question, how do you negotiate the thin line between courage and recklessness? I wonder if you could comment on that in terms of her and what it might have taught you, because you also put yourself in danger.
Yes. I always like to think I take calculated risks, but calculated risks are still risks. And in terms of her, she has definitely a reckless streak, no question about it. She was rather fearless, but there were reasons to be afraid, and she often ignored them. She would face down men who, you know, she felt needed to be put back in line. She was very confident, very bold, and also very committed to doing what she felt needed to be done in a desperate situation. Where there were no leaders, someone had to take charge of the situation. Someone had to begin to do things, whether it was becoming a conduit for aid and donations, or, as she did later, was to start an ad hoc school in her apartment. She was a very practical, pragmatic person, but sort of person who wouldn't take no for an answer, and when she felt something was morally justified, would do it in the face of obvious risk. As for myself, I mean, I really respected this, because what I was seeing were that the international NGOs, and there were a good number of them in Syria, but they really had their hands tied. They were unable to do very much at all, partly because there was a lot of red tape in terms of dealing with the Syrian authorities, who were paranoid about outsiders and assumed that everyone was a spy. So they weren't able to accomplish very much. And so for her, this was frustrating, and she saw ways of just getting things done, and she did them. And so for me, this was really optimistic and hopeful, and there wasn't a lot to be hopeful about. So I was really drawn to that. She's a very charismatic person. So her boldness, I think it gave me courage as well. And perhaps at times when we should have been a little more circumspect.
Yes. I mean, this is titled Disappearance in Damascus. And she did disappear at one point. She did disappear. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about what led up to that.
So I had spent 3 or 4 months on the ground in Syria. I also was also in Jordan and Lebanon, interviewing, doing field work, collecting stories in order to write this long feature piece for Harper's. And when I left and I was finished my field work, there were signs that things weren't good for her. And one of the things that happened was she started to be called in for, let me go back a bit. She had noticed that she was being followed, and she had seen a man camped outside of her apartment building, and he was taking photos of her when she came and went. She also noticed that 2 men had followed her when she went to buy groceries, and they were pretending to take pictures of one another, but the flash went off in her face. So she knew she was being followed. And shortly after that, she was called into the intelligence headquarters in her neighborhood. And the head of intelligence there said, "Who are you? You know, you're running around from 6 a.m. until midnight. I've sent 3 men to follow you, and they can't keep up." And she said, well, they must be out of shape, because that was her way of kind of deflecting the shock that this was who was following her. Prior to that, she thought it might have been the men who kidnapped her when she was in Baghdad, because it was not uncommon at all for Iraqi militias to follow their prey across the border. And, of course, you know, kidnapping was the biggest and remains one of the biggest money-making spheres in the economy during the breakdown of all other industries. So she was really shocked to learn that it was the Syrian secret police that were actually following her. Now they hadn't done anything. They had just asked her for details about what she was doing, who she was working for, etc. They were very interested in the fact that she was working for Western foreign correspondents, and they also wanted her to start working for them as a spy, looking at, for example, other refugees. If anything happened, they wanted to know. She refused to do that, and that made her more of a target. So at one point, I decided that I needed to go back to Syria because I hadn't heard from her for a while. She'd stopped answering her phone, stopped answering her emails, and I became worried. And I had a feeling something wasn't right, but I didn't know from abroad what to do about it. So because I write for a lot of magazines, I figured, well, I'll just go back. I'll do some more reporting. I'll do another story. I had a tentative assignment, and I went back. And a week and a half after I arrived and found her, and she had told me that she'd been hauled in again and that she'd been warned to stop working with journalists and that she hadn't answered my calls because she was worried about the possibility of putting me in danger. But things seemed somewhat okay. So that morning, the morning when everything took place, I was living in her neighborhood by this time, and I went to her place as usual in the morning. She always had the news of the neighborhood and of Iraq because she had so many contacts there. And I felt strange walking to her neighborhood, just that feeling you have at the back of your neck like you're being watched. And at the same time, being the only Westerner living in this neighborhood, I was used to curiosity, and so I thought, well, I'm just being paranoid. I'm always a little paranoid when I'm out in the field and I'm working undercover, which is another thing I should mention, is that I had gone as a professor because I teach at a university, and I didn't want to register with the Syrian authorities and put myself on their radar and be followed and have my sources followed. So I arrived at her place, and a few minutes later, there was a knock at the door. And a man came in, and I could immediately tell he was one of those people that no matter what he's wearing, he looks like he's wearing a uniform. And I immediately knew what was going on. He came up to her, and the three of us just stood there for a moment. And then he said to Ahlam in Arabic, "Get rid of her." And she came up to me and said to me, go now. And it was the strangest moment because she, who was normally so animated, so full of life, had a completely flat expression, and that's what really scared me. So I left, and fortunately I had my notebook with me, and of course, you know, one has names and such, phone numbers, and I began to be very worried about all the people I had talked to. So I went back to where I was staying and waited. And she said, you know, it's just going to be a few hours. They've done this before. They've called me in many times. But I could feel something was different. And she didn't come back.
Yes, and that was a terrifying time. She did eventually manage to get out and came to the U.S., but she was changed. How?
When I first saw her after her release, she seemed the same. She was so overjoyed. She has two children, and she was so overjoyed to be out of prison, to be back with her son and daughter, and to be free. I think, you know, that joy of survival, that feeling of euphoria that you get when suddenly what you thought was your fate has been removed from you. And then she lives in the U.S. now in Chicago. And then slowly over the course of the next year or two, I began to see that, you know, when you stop running and settle into a little bit more safety, a lot of things begin to come back to you. And things that you may have been avoiding while you've been surviving. And I saw that she was experiencing flashbacks. So little things would trigger them, like the sound of police sirens. And also the things that she had seen in Iraq were so horrific. And so even when she would hear a baby crying, suddenly she would have these flashbacks, these kind of cold sweats. So she was definitely, you know, affected by that. I don't see how she could not have been, to be honest.
and we're talking with journalist Deborah Campbell about her book, A Disappearance in Damascus, A Story of Friendship and Survival in the Shadow of War. Yeah, you ask, how can anyone survive this and remain human? I mean, this is not just about her and her story, but all the refugees. You know, you say at one point that she gave you a new way about thinking about war and what it takes to survive. Do you feel that she survived? What did you learn about survival? What can anyone learn about surviving these horrific experiences?
I don't think that we survive without scars, without sometimes our scars are badges of honor for having survived things. But when I say that she managed to remain human, I mean that she managed to remain open, open to connecting with people, to trusting people, to a kind of generosity of spirit. When I was living among the refugees, I found a lot of them really in shock and unable to really, almost pulled into themselves, which is unexpected when you've been through something traumatic. And people become often less generous. And she became more generous and braver and laughed in the face of death in many ways. So this is what I mean. She managed to pick herself up when she was going through devastating loss and still reach out and still find ways of making meaning out of chaos. And for her, this would be a lot of her social projects, her community organization projects, and sometimes just her sense of humor and her ability to laugh at very dark things. And she's not lost that. Now she has not lost that. I just saw her recently, and we still connect. We've always connected through humor and through sometimes black humor and perhaps a bit of bravado on both of our parts. But she was more alive than anyone I've ever known.
And this is just, this book is such a terrific homage to her, really, Disappearance in Damascus. Deborah Campbell, this has just been so wonderful to talk with you. It's a very rich book. It's, as I've said before, it's not just her story, but her story as it illumines the entire human consequences of the wars that we seem to get into so easily and with such recklessness.
And part of the book, I also talk about journalism and what's happened to journalism and what's still happening. We're in a real crisis of good reporting, and we know what's happened to newspapers closing down and foreign bureaus closing, and so we get a few loud voices that dominate our mediascape, even though most of us seem to be wired into it for half of every day. We're wired into less and less quality. And so people, you know, when they're uninformed or ill-informed or misinformed, tend to support policies that are ignorant, and they never get a chance to actually see what happens when those policies follow through. So that was one of my goals in my early reporting and in writing this book, was to chronicle some of that and to show people, to basically take them with me so they felt like they were there and got to see it from the inside in a human way. And she was my door, my conduit to that, to allow me to tell that story and show Americans and the world what really happened over there.
Yeah, I mean, for example, there's one story you tell or something that you inform the reader of that I really didn't know about, and that is what has happened to adolescent girls, these refugees, the Iraqi refugees, but now, of course, the Syrian refugees as well. And this was something that Alam tried to address. Tell us, what is the position of adolescent girls in among the refugee population?
Mm-hmm. Well, Alam in particular had a lot of compassion for adolescent girls because she had gone through many obstacles to be able to go to high school at all. And she had the advantage of having a very respected father who could fight for her, and also a society where education was really opening up for girls. So by the time 2003 came along, more than 90% of Iraqi women were literate, and girls and women were highly educated. You had women in all the high positions working as doctors and lawyers and professors, and it was very normal to not only go to high school but to go to university. And this is the same for Syria. So when I was there, it was first of all, university's free. So all the women that I knew had at least one degree, and that was very normal. And also, you know, you could go out on your own. You had a lot of personal freedoms, too. Now, in a war state, that's all gone, completely gone. So you miss education, and as soon as you lose education, of course, this is devastating for an entire generation. But what happens specifically to the adolescent girls is that they become really vulnerable to exploitation. What was happening were, in many cases, sexual exploitation. So forced marriages were very common, and early marriages, and the marriage age was dropping very quickly. And sometimes this would be because families were very worried about predators in a strange country, and so they wanted their daughters to be married and essentially taken care of, and they felt like this was a kind of protection. But also, in forced marriages, there could be an exchange of money, and there were men coming from, you know, rich Gulf countries that were buying 12 and 14 year old girls as quote unquote brides and taking them away. And you also had some families that would force their daughters into prostitution. You had an enormous number of widows that were doing sex work in order to feed their children because there was no other work available for them. And they didn't have job skills because they had been stay-at-home moms. And the other thing was gangs that were trafficking girls, especially orphans. And there were so many orphans from the war. So boys might join a militia, even be forced to join a militia, but girls would be forced into the sex trade. And there were tens of thousands of women and girls working in Damascus, refugees working in the sex trade. And this is not something that they chose in any respect. And, you know, teenage girls on the radar of aid agencies and the world consciousness, they tend to fall through the cracks. So we tend to not think about them. And so there's just very little going on to help them. And Ahmam felt just a real sense of obligation towards them. And that's what inspired her to open just a small school out of her apartment, and not simply to educate. I mean, they were teaching English and French and math, and there were a lot of Iraqis who had been teachers that were happy to volunteer as teachers, but also to give these girls a community, a sense that there were other girls that they could share their experiences with. That was really important to her. And she also wanted them to have fun, which is something that completely disappears from childhood in war.
Well, Deborah Campbell, I'm so glad that you wrote this book about Ahlam and about Iraqi refugees in Syria. It's called Disappearance in Damascus. Thanks so much for talking with us here.
Oh, my pleasure.
Deborah Campbell is an award-winning journalist who has reported from Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, and elsewhere. A Disappearance in Damascus won the 2016 Hillary Weston Writers' Trust Prize, Canada's largest literary award for nonfiction. Read an excerpt at writersvoice.net. Next up, one Syrian refugee's story of love, loss, and survival. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Donald Trump doesn't want Syrian refugees to come here, although no Syrian refugees have ever carried out a terrorist attack in the U.S. But they are fleeing terror and destruction in their own country. Terror from bombs dropped by Russia, the U.S., and their own government. Destruction of their homes and communities by both government troops and the opposition. According to Amnesty International, 2017 is set to be the deadliest year for refugees crossing the Mediterranean. Back in March, we spoke with UNHCR spokesperson Melissa Fleming about her book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, One Refugee's Incredible Story of Love, Loss, and Survival. It tells the story of Doa Al-Samel, a young Syrian refugee who survived a harrowing journey across the Mediterranean from Turkey to Italy. She was one of about 25 survivors out of 500 whose boat was deliberately attacked by smugglers. Her fiancé, the love of her life, did not survive. Doa floated in the sea for days, carrying two babies in her arms whose parents had handed them to her before she drowned. We re-air our interview with Melissa Fleming about that story today. Melissa Fleming, welcome to Writer's Voice.
It's great to be with you.
You are the chief spokesperson for the UNHCR, the UN High Commission on Refugees. You first told Doa's story on the TED stage, and I watched your presentation there, your talk. You say there that you ask each refugee, what did you take when you fled? And I wanted to first ask you, why do you ask that question?
Well, you know, I think it's very telling when you ask a refugee what they fled, because it shows actually what means most to them. So when you're about to lose everything, potentially even, you know, your family members, you don't know, you're in such a state of danger when you have to flee, that you think about, you know, when you what to take. It has to be something incredibly important. And I just find when I ask refugees, it's extremely telling. It's often either something that's going to be extremely useful to them in their journey, or it's something very sentimental.
So did you ask Doa that question?
I did ask Doa that question, yes. And she had a little bit more time. She didn't have to rush, but she could only take one suitcase. So she did take a lot of little small trinkets that, you know, meant something to her over her childhood. And had to leave behind some heavy things like books. But there were also some pieces of clothes that were really important for her to pack. But it definitely was difficult to make the decision. She was so very convinced that her departure from Syria at that point was only going to be temporary. So she was hopeful that she was going to be able to return back to her town, her community, her apartment, and her bed.
She is a remarkable young woman. Tell us a little bit about Doa herself.
Well, she's a quite headstrong and stubborn young woman, too, which, you know, in many ways became something, a strength in her personality. It probably helped her in her survival at many points, but it also made her stand out a little bit. She was determined that she wasn't going to be like the other girls who were just going to get married and have babies. She wanted to study. When the war broke out, she was absolutely determined that she was going to be out there protesting in the streets no matter what the danger. And also, you know, when she was a refugee and her soon-to-be fiancé was in hot pursuit of her, it took him a long time. It was very Shakespearean it took a very, very long time for him to convince her and win her over.
Let's go back a bit, because you start the book by really talking about the roots of the Syrian crisis. I found it very interesting that you include environmental issues at the root of this. So I wonder if you could tell us, how did the Syrian crisis develop?
Well, you know, there are lots of theories, including that environmental issues, a drought, had something to do with it, because there were, during the drought, there were, you know, scores of people who started, farmers who started to move to the cities and weren't finding their livelihoods there. And so there was an edginess, more disgruntlement among the population when actually the Arab Spring started happening around, and they were watching their television screens and thinking, wow, I wonder if this could happen in Syria. And all of a sudden, you know, the oppression didn't seem so daunting that they thought maybe, well, we could go out and express ourselves too and ask for things of our government that we never dared to. So this is what Doa witnessed. What's remarkable about Doa's story is that she was actually in the the town where the war was sparked, and she knew and witnessed a lot of the events that transpired that turned it from peaceful protest to armed conflict.
And she joined the peaceful protests herself. Tell us a little bit about her work there. I mean, just the indomitable courage that she had, and also a little bit about her family and their reaction to this.
Well, you know, the Stoakot came from a very simple, poor family. Her father was a barber. There were seven children. Very tight, very close, very happy family, not a political family at all. But she just had this sense of right and wrong and justice and injustice. And when she witnessed her government firing on peaceful protesters, she was so determined that this was wrong and that she wanted to be a part of a new movement in Syria. And so she insisted on going out, and even in small ways, you know, she would spend hours in the evenings making beads the color of the revolution, the little bead bracelets that she would hand out. And she'd go out to the protests when she was allowed, and that was, you know, during the afternoons with her friends, and just basically take part, play roles. She even, you know, would throw grenades back that were, you know, rolling towards them. So she had various roles, cutting up onions to help mitigate the effects of the tear gas. And so she did this day after day until it became too dangerous and her father started to say no.
And her father had his own business in Syria. The family wasn't rich, but they were not poor either.
You know, Syria was a place that had a very strong infrastructure. The schools were good. The medical care was good. So, you know, if you had, you know, a place to work, you could pretty much support your family. There was certainly, you know, plenty of vegetables and fruit and to feed people. The prices were not that expensive. So, yes, they lived. They didn't live an extravagant life, but they had a decent home and they had plenty to eat. And they had, you know, kind of a wonderful community. It all came crashing down with the war, of course, and very literally when a bomb hit his shop, and then his entire livelihood was lost.
So they had to flee to Egypt.
Yeah, well, it was really the last resort. I think mostly Doa's father, more than anything, was worried about his girls, because there were rumors going around that young women were being abducted, kidnapped, raped, and that was, he couldn't even bear the thought of that happening to his daughters. And so he and his wife decided that they had to go. And they were, you know, pretty much among the first wave of refugees in 2012 that left. They had a connection to Egypt, and so they just decided to go there. And there was the government in power then under Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood, was very welcoming towards Syrian refugees. So when they arrived, actually, not just other refugee families welcomed them into their new communities, but also the locals, the local government, you know, provided help and welcome to the Azamal family.
So that began to change. Why did that change? Well, first, why were they so welcomed into Egypt at first, and then what made the situation change so drastically?
Well, there was a coup d'etat, and the current president, who's still president today, Sisi, associated Syrian refugees with the former government, with the Muslim Brotherhood government. And there were all kinds of not very nice things said, even on national television. And it seemed from one day to the next, the kind of feeling of welcome when they walked down the street, the smiles had turned to either silence or even the feeling of real hostility. And the girls also started feeling that they were being harassed. And you know, this was politicizing refugees when actually they were just there seeking refuge and respite from the awful conflict that they fled from.
So this is as we're seeing so much right now in the United States as well, the politicization of refugees is such a striking problem. Before we go back to the story of Doa, I wonder if you could talk, just from the point of view of your position at the UNHCR, about this politicization of refugees worldwide and how, you know, how you feel about it.
Well, it really worries us when refugees who are basically the people, what we call them very often is the most vulnerable people in the world. I mean, these are people who are actually fleeing from violence, fleeing from terrorism, and then they're being accused of being associated with that very violence and terrorism. And we just believe this is a complete false narrative. It's done very often to provoke the fear that might be underlying in voters and to achieve a cheap way of getting votes. Refugees, for example, coming to the United States are the most vetted human beings that would ever enter our country. So it actually doesn't make sense to associate them with any danger at all, frankly. So we honestly believe it is rather irresponsible, and the people who are the refugees who we care for all the time are the ones who need actually our sympathy. They need our access to just a place to be free of violence until they can go home. And that's what most refugees want to do anyway.
And you tell that story of that vulnerability so powerfully in this book, Melissa Fleming, in this book, A Hope More Powerful Than the Sea, The Journey of Doa Al-Samel. Back to Doa, she meets the love of her life. His name is Bassem. You've already spoken a bit about him, about how he wooed her very determinedly. Tell us a little bit about Bassem.
Well, Bassem was also from Dara, where Doa was from, but they didn't know each other. And they ended up in the same pretty much building block in Egypt. And the first time he saw her, it was just love at first sight for him. She had no interest in him whatsoever, nor did she have any interest in any man. But he was just completely taken, and he had just come out of Syria. He didn't talk much about what happened to him, but it was clear that he had been imprisoned by the government and that he had been tortured. And what he wanted now was just some light in his life. And that's what he saw in Doa. And she, unfortunately, just thought that this was just nothing for her right now. It wasn't the time for love. But he pursued her, and he tried every trick, including wooing her mother, her sisters, and always being there to help when things were going wrong. And it seemed that one day she saw the light and recognized that he really was the one for her.
And he despaired at one point and told her he was going to go back to Syria.
Well, that, I think, is what really switched her, because she realized that she probably was kind of enjoying this courtship and that she probably did have feelings for him that she was not admitting. And when he finally said, you know what, Doa, I see that I'm giving up. I'm going back to Syria. I'm going back to fight. And she thought that not only would she lose him, but she might even be responsible for his death. That's when she completely changed and said, okay, I'm reconsidering. And maybe you can go ask my dad for my hand in marriage.
He wanted to flee Egypt. At first, she did not want to do that. Why did he want to go? What were her hesitations? And then why did she ultimately agree to go with him?
Well, I mean, one of the things I think this book shows is what a struggle refugee life is for the Syrian refugees living in the neighboring countries of Syria. And that is because, I mean, these countries themselves are hosting so many refugees, have their own economic issues, but also, you know, my organization, UNHCR, is chronically underfunded. So the refugees there are really living hand to mouth. And Bassem and Doa were working kind of labor jobs. And, you know, he was, you know, coming home covered in coal and then having to go out and work again in the evening. And he just thought, this is no life for me. And he was getting messages from his friends on Facebook who had decided that they were going to go to Europe and try to restart their lives there. And they had made it. And they were photos of them in front of a university in Amsterdam and another talking about his work and his job in Germany. And so he said, Doa, you know, if we go there, then we can not just live in safety, but we can restart our lives. You can study, I can work. And she, though, was absolutely adamant that she wasn't going to do this. She was terrified of the water. She had a near drowning experience as a 6-year-old, never learned to swim, and she was also not naive about the dangers. Nevertheless, you know, the smugglers convinced them they would be on a really safe, not quite a luxury liner, but a safe boat, and it would take them to Italy, and then they could move upwards to the north of Europe. So finally, she let herself be persuaded.
This is a harrowing section of this book. I'll leave some of it to the imagination of the reader, because I think it really has to be read to get the full understanding of what happened. But I'd like you to talk a bit about the smuggling itself, just the conditions of people who are escaping, not just Doa and Bassem, but all the other people. What is the process of them contacting smugglers? Who's running these smuggling operations? What kind of people are they?
Well, it's a thriving criminal business that is exploiting the desperation of refugees and really exploiting them. And these are people who have absolutely no regard for human life. They take their money. They take lots of money. In Doa and Bassem's case, it was $2,500 each, which was for them, you know, it was everything they had, and said they sold off a lot of things too. And, you know, they take the money, and they also then put them on pretty much unseaworthy. If the boats are seaworthy, then they're overcrowded to the extent that they're just dangerous and ready to capsize. And, you know, last year on the Mediterranean Sea, 5,000 people died. 5,000 people drowned. And already this year, the numbers are well over 2,000 who have drowned trying to cross to Italy. So it's a business that is ruthless, and it's there to collect money and has no regard for what happens to the men, women, and children who they put on these rickety boats.
2,000 people have died already, and we're only at the beginning of March?
Yes, that's right. And then now the season is going to start where more and more people will be, you know, setting sail. So, yes, already more than 2,000 people have died so far this year. And we fear that, you know, with the spring coming and more people taking to the boats, the death toll is going to continue to go up.
And also talk about the pirates.
Well, you mean with what happened with the ramming of the boat?
Yeah.
They weren't really necessarily pirates. They looked like pirates to Doa. They were probably part of this smuggling gang, and probably they calculated that they'd already, you know, earned $1 million off the backs of the 500 people on that boat and didn't really want to take the responsibility, or no one will ever know why they did it, because there was never any international investigation. But in any case, they rammed this boat intentionally, according to all the survivors I've spoken to, yelled as the boat was sinking, "Let the fish eat your flesh," and were laughing as the boat was sinking to the bottom of the sea, with everybody below deck instantly doomed. So these were people who wanted to see all those refugees die in front of them.
I'm just speechless, really, at the thought of this evil. And yet this is really also part of a larger system. It's not just the pirates who are doing evil, but a whole system that makes their work possible.
Well, you know, where people are desperate, there'll always be criminal networks that will exploit desperate people. I think that the goal is for the world to remove this need for people to have to risk their lives across the seas to reach a safe place. Obviously, you know, more needs to be done to stop the wars that are driving so many people from their homes. But also, you know, more investment in the neighboring countries that are hosting 86% of the world's refugees. Invest in those countries, help them with their infrastructure so that they can continue to host so many. And also, one of the things that really strikes me is that there are just not enough schools for the kids. And this is what was one of the main drivers of many refugee families coming to Europe. They said, "Look, I couldn't put my kids in school." and I want them to have a future. So that's why I'm coming here. And for me, that's, as a mother, that's a perfectly reasonable argument. If I couldn't put my kids in school, maybe 1 year I could tolerate it, but year after year, and then no hope of going back to Syria in sight, that is a compelling reason. So I think there are lots of ways that we could ensure that the smuggler business loses its business model. There are other ways, and that's UNHCR's resettlement program, which vets refugees who are living in neighboring countries and allows them to come on airplanes and resettle in communities in countries that have the capacity, including the United States, to take them in. So more of that would really help alleviate or stop the smuggler business.
And yet none of that is happening. If anything, it seems that the world is closing its borders. What is the situation now for refugees who do make it across the Mediterranean?
It's looking pretty grim these days. So if they do make it across, many of them are stuck in Greece because there's no chance for them really to move on anywhere else. Europe has sent a signal, you know, please don't come here. The only way, and most people don't know this, for a refugee to seek asylum in Europe is to actually physically arrive in that country. You cannot ask for asylum in an embassy. So they really do not have a choice if they want to ask for asylum in Europe, but to try to get there. So the journey has become very difficult. Walls have gone up and other restrictions are in place. And so, yeah, we are seeing fewer and fewer Syrians and Iraqis attempting the journey, but there are still many, many others who are.
So they are stuck in countries which are overflowing with refugees, don't have the resources to integrate them, where there are growing tensions of their own. They make a harrowing journey, often losing their lives or their members of their family, and then find a cold welcome on the other side. This is unsustainable.
It is unsustainable. And Europe is, you know, aware of this. And there are lots of meetings and conferences and good minds who are putting their heads together and thinking about how we can improve the situation for refugees while working on peace and while sharing the responsibility. Unfortunately, not all the governments in Europe are willing to share responsibility. Countries like Germany, Austria, and Sweden, you know, took in the vast majority of the refugees that were coming to Europe. And the expectation was that other countries would do the same. And had they done the same, there would not be any talk of a Europe crisis, because the numbers would have been distributed in a way that it would not have really been noticeable. But because those three countries took on almost all the refugees, just did become a crisis, and it became a political issue in those countries and around Europe.
Melissa Fleming is a spokesperson for the UNHCR. We originally aired our interview with her in March 2017. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.